Today is Monday, September 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, ahead of the UN General Assembly, U.S. President Donald Trump continues to defend his conversation with Ukraine.
The conversation, by the way, was absolutely perfect.
Also ahead, demonstrations continued yet again in Hong Kong as protesters clash with authorities, and we take a look at the international vaping bans. Those stories and more are all coming up next. U.S. President Donald Trump said Sunday he did nothing wrong in a telephone conversation with the new president of Ukraine amid news reports that Mr. Trump urged him to investigate the son of former vice president and 2020 Democratic presidential hopeful Joe Biden.
Well, this whistleblower, or whoever it was, because it sounds like it's not a whistleblower, you can't have that happen to a president of the United States. The conversation, by the way, was absolutely perfect. It was a beautiful, warm, nice conversation.
According to news reports, Trump urged Zelensky about eight times during their conversation to investigate Biden's son. Sources were quoted saying Trump's intent was to get Zelensky to collaborate with Trump lawyer Rudolph Giuliani on an investigation that could undermine Biden. In an interview with ABC's This Week, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says President Trump brought up the issue Americans should be aware of in his conversation with the Ukrainian president.
America cannot have our elections interfered with. And if that's what took place there, if there was that kind of activity engaged in by Vice President Biden, we need to know.
Joining International Edition with more is VOA White House correspondent Patsy Wita-Sukwara. So, Patsy, what can you tell us about what the White House is saying, what the president is saying about his rationale that he did nothing wrong?
Well, of course, the president is saying that this whole whistleblower scandal is partisan and that the Democrats and the news media are initiating a new witch hunt against him. So just to take our audience back, this is all in regards to a July 25 phone call where the president is said to have pressed the president of Ukraine, President Zelensky, to investigate Joe Biden's younger son, Hunter, who sat on the board of a Ukrainian energy company, based on the president's unsubstantiated theory that Hunter Biden was trying to protect the company from prosecution when he called for the firing of Ukraine's top prosecutor in 2016. And today, the president said that what Joe Biden did was practically an offer. He said actually beyond an offer. It was something, according to the president, where he said, or Joe Biden said, I'm not going to give billions of dollars to Ukraine unless they remove this prosecutor. Again, this is unsubstantiated, and this whole issue is coming up because of a whistleblower in the intelligence community who filed a complaint about the president's actions.
And according to what I understand and what's been taking place over the last few days, the White House is trying to block the information going to the Congressional Oversight Committees, correct?
Correct. And that is really what's getting the Democrats all up in arms and saying that this is a new reason why we should continue to investigate the president, and this may be creating louder and louder calls for impeachment.
Now, this is all coming as the president heads to the UN General Assembly coming up. What is the White House hoping to achieve during these next few days of talks at the UN?
Well, there are a few things that I can highlight. The first one is that it seems that President Trump is really setting his own agenda. Instead of joining other leaders to support the UN climate change agenda, he has his own focus. And in fact, he's hosting a key event on Monday that overlaps exactly at the same time as a meeting on environment. So this event is called the Global Call to Protect Religious Freedom. So this is an effort that the administration is saying they're trying to do to broaden international support for protecting religious freedom. Now, the experts that I speak to say that this is really an effort to reach his base, particularly evangelicals, because the focus here is on Christian minorities. So it would be interesting to see what comes out of this initiative and whether the push for protection is given to other religious minorities, the Rohingyas, for example, or what, for example, Trump called on China on their treatment of Uyghurs. So these are the kinds of things that people will look out to see if this is a genuine initiative or something that's more intended for a domestic audience. And the other reason why this initiative is met with skepticism is that it's really is a departure from the president's August speech in 2018, when he flat out rejected the doctrine of globalism, saying that the U.S. will not tell the world how to live or work or worship. Aside from that, obviously the big issue is Iran and whether the president would be able to coordinate a united front after the attacks on Saudi oil facility that Washington is blaming on Tehran. We'll see how strongly he speaks on this issue on his speech in front of the assembly, as well as in the UN Security Council meeting, which he would be chairing, because this is the U.S.'s turn to lead the council this month. There's also a meeting with the Lima Group to discuss Venezuela, a number of bilats.
Patsy Wiedekoswara reports for VOA from the White House. Thank you so much for your preview of the UNGA meeting taking place in New York, as well as the update on the whistleblower incident.
My pleasure.
Hong Kong police fired tear gas on Sunday to break up pro-democracy protesters who trashed fittings at a railway station and a shopping mall, the latest confrontation in more than 3 months of often violent unrest. Joining us live from Hong Kong now by phone is journalist Justin Solomon. Justin, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, Justin, can you take us through this past weekend's protests? And I understand you were out there covering them on Saturday.
I was. Look, it's another weekend of violent protests here in Hong Kong. We're sort of getting used to it here, where the police line up on one side of the street and protesters line up on the other, and it's who shoots first, really. So on Saturday, I was outside of a train station where the protesters were once again throwing Molotov cocktails and bricks at the police, and instantaneously the police put up a what is known here as the black flag, which is a flag warning of tear gas, and seconds later, of course, tear gas gets fired. That, of course, causes the protesters to scramble to yet another location, which is what we saw all weekend long. From they would bounce from one location to another, which goes to they're saying be water, be fluid, be able to move and adapt to situations, and that's certainly what they're doing.
And these protests really show no sign of slowing down at all. I mean, what can you tell us about as we move into this week? Because on Thursday, Chief Executive Carrie Lam is to meet with community members.
Yeah, she's expected to meet with community members. Members of the community were allowed to register to be a part of this. From my understanding, only 150 people will be allowed into this meeting, and it's being held in a very large space, so it's kind of an odd number. They're trying to keep it small. Protests are going to continue throughout the week leading up to October 1st, though. They are smaller in size when it comes to the violent aspects of things, but there are certainly larger celebratory feeling protests, if that makes sense, where groups are gathering, singing this new song called Glory to Hong Kong, which the protesters are calling their anthem. They're going to local malls, local parks, holding hands. And we're going to see more of that this week leading up to October 1st, which, of course, is the 70th anniversary of the founding of the Republic.
Speaking of continued protests, you know, one of the things that you see in the videos, the stills out there, are the protesters standing up with their hands extended, the number five, meaning five demands, not one less. Has there been any indication from Carrie Lam or other officials that they're looking to, you know, meet those other demands?
Look, right now, there is no indication that the other demands will be met. Of course, we know one of the demands, the full withdrawal of the extradition bill, was met a few weeks back. But the protesters, that didn't do much for them, really, because it, of course, has grown much larger than just the extradition bill. The government has clearly stated that they have given way on this. They are opening doors to dialogue, but nothing further, no indication of meeting any of these demands.
Justin Solomon is a reporter based out of Hong Kong. He's joining us by phone this evening. Thank you so much for your time.
Good to talk to you.
The Arab bloc in Israel's parliament abandoned its usual hands-off stance Sunday and endorsed former military chief Benny Gantz for prime minister, potentially giving him the edge over hardline incumbent Benjamin Netanyahu. The historic move marked the first time in nearly three decades that the Arab parties backed a candidate for prime minister, reflecting their contempt for Netanyahu, who was accused of fomenting hatred of Arabs during his re-election campaign. It will be up to Israeli President Reuven Rivlin to decide which candidate should be given the chance to form a coalition government and serve as prime minister. A visiting Afghan Taliban delegation held talks with senior officials in China Sunday to discuss the Islamist insurgent group's now-defunct peace negotiations with the United States. The insurgents' visit comes 2 weeks after U.S. President Donald Trump abruptly called off his administration's month-long peace talks, citing ongoing Taliban deadly attacks in Afghanistan. The two adversaries were believed to be on the verge of signing an agreement to end the 18-year-old Afghan war before Trump declared the peace talks dead. Europe's leading automotive trade groups joined forces Monday to warn about the catastrophic consequences of a no-deal Brexit. European-wide industry groups and 21 national auto associations, including Britain's Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders, said new tariffs on cars and vans could cost the EU and UK industry $6.3 billion if Britain departs the European Union without an agreement. Customers would face higher prices if manufacturers cannot absorb the additional costs. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has said that he intends to take the UK out of the European Union on October 31st, with or without a deal. Iran will not allow anyone to violate its borders, says President Hassan Rouhani in Tehran Sunday at a ceremony commemorating the anniversary of the start of the Islamic Republic's 1980-1988 war with Iraq. Reuters reporter Emmer McCarthy has that story.
Iran will present a plan for creating security in the Gulf to the United Nations this week, the country's president Hassan Rouhani said on Sunday, amid heightened tensions with two of its longtime foes, Saudi Arabia and the United States.
We will present a plan to the world in the coming days at the United Nations that the Islamic Republic of Iran, in cooperation with the countries of the region, can create security and safety for the Persian Gulf, the Oman Sea, and the Strait of Hormuz, with the help of the countries of the region.
Rouhani made his remarks at a ceremony commemorating the anniversary of the start of the Islamic Republic's war with Iraq in 1980. It comes as Saudi Arabia and the United States continue to point the finger at Iran for an attack on Saudi oil facilities on September 14, the largest ever such assault on the world's top oil exporter. On Friday, US President Donald Trump approved sending American troops to bolster Saudi Arabia's air and missile defenses after the attack.
We are the people of logic and negotiation, but we are not the people of abjection and surrender. We are men of defense and resistance, but we are not someone who will violate the borders of others, just as we will not allow anyone to violate our borders.
Iran denies involvement in the attack, which was claimed by Yemen's Houthi movement.
And that was Reuters reporter Emmer McCarthy. And this is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
What quality is most important to you when looking for a long-term partner? A new study led by Swansea University in Wales found the attribute people find most important is kindness. The study authors recruited 3,000 college students from campuses around the world. They gave the students a set budget of so-called mate dollars to purchase amounts of 8 distinct characteristics that would produce their ideal mate. While the students did spend a bit of their budget on good looks or good financial prospects, they spent most of their budget, between 22 and 26%, on kindness. Other attributes they could purchase were humor, chastity, religiosity, the desire for children, and creativity. According to the study, creativity and chastity were considered the least important traits, getting less than 10% of the students' budgets. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The World Health Organization said Saturday that Tanzania has failed to respond to requests about information on suspected Ebola cases. The WHO said in a statement that it has been made aware of unofficial reports about several possible cases of Ebola in different locations in the East African country. The statement said the identified contacts of a suspected victim in Dar es Salaam were unofficially reported to be quarantined in various sites in the country. In addition, the limited available official information from Tanzanian authorities represents a challenge for assessing the risk, according to the WHO. Officials in East and Central Africa are on an Ebola high alert. They are seeking to avoid the spread of the disease that has experienced an outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo that's killed more than 2,000 people since August 2018. Climate activists on Sunday scaled a Swiss mountain to hold a funeral for an alpine glacier they said will be lost forever due to global warming. Reuters' Zachary Goldman has the details.
A line of several dozen hikers climb a rocky, picturesque mountainside in the Swiss Alps. And in addition to climbing gear, many are dressed in costume formal black in the bright Sunday sunshine. Some of the men wear black hats, some of the women black lace veils in the thin alpine air. Because this is a funeral of sorts. These are climate activists, and they're mourning what they say is the death of a glacier due to global warming. The Pisol Glacier perches almost 8,500 feet above sea level near the border with Austria, and all that's left are a few patches of white against the mountain. Matthias Hus is the head of the Swiss Glacier's monitoring network.
So at present we still have a size, ice-covered size of about 4 football fields, so it's already a very small glacier. But the retreat has strongly accelerated in the last 2 years. So in 2018, it has started to disintegrate. It has lost 40% of its area, and now this year, again, more. So we have really almost lost everything. We have some little ice patches left, but really not much.
The activists hold a ceremony marking the loss of the alpine ice.
We have built up a relation to these glaciers over the time, and many of the people that are here have probably some kind of relation. And so it's a sad day where people say goodbye to this glacier as we do it to humans that we have loved.
One man blows an alp horn.
We can basically not save this glacier. This glacier is a symbol that glaciers are disappearing, that the ice is melting in the Alps. We cannot save this glacier, but there are many other glaciers that we can potentially save by protecting the climate. The bigger glaciers, they can still be saved, but also in a smaller size.
Activists such as Hus see the loss as a call to action to prevent climate change from permanently altering the face of the planet.
And that was Reuters reporter Zachary Goldman. Longtime British tour company Thomas Cook collapsed after failing to secure rescue funding and travel bookings for its more than 600,000 global vacationers were canceled early Monday. The British government said the return of the firm's 150,000 British customers now abroad would be the largest repatriation in its peacetime history. The process is set to begin later Monday, and officials warned that delays are inevitable. The 178-year-old company had said Friday it was seeking £200 million or $250 million to avoid going bust and was in the weekend talks with shareholders and creditors to stave off the failure. A bipartisan group of U.S. senators on Friday urged federal regulators to immediately remove all pod and cartridge-based e-cigarettes from the market until they can be proven as products being safe. U.S. health officials also said on Thursday that there were now 530 confirmed and probable cases and 7 deaths from severe lung-related illnesses tied to vaping, with no signs of the outbreak easing. 3/4 of the cases are male, and 2/3 were between the ages of 18 and 34. U.S. officials have now activated emergency measures to tackle the recent spate of lung illnesses blamed on electronic cigarettes. Although most of the affected have remained anonymous, one of the sufferers has taken to social media to announce her adversity to vaping and e-cigarettes. Seema Herman from Los Angeles posted a picture of herself holding up a sign saying, "I want to start a no vaping campaign," after waking up from a medically induced coma from her hospital bed.
I realized I had a tube in my throat. I realized like I had all these IVs and like where I was. And I wrote that sign, "I want to start a no vaping campaign." And I knew what it was before anyone else did. I woke up and I immediately realized I can't breathe. Why can't people breathe most of the time? They smoke. I was vaping like while I was doing it. I had no idea that that's where it would lead me. But once I was in that position, I knew pretty much immediately that that's what it was. And I knew that all my friends were doing it at the time. So I wrote that sign and put it on my Snapchat story just to warn them.
Dr. Adam Goldstein is a professor and the director of tobacco intervention programs at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I asked him why the public is just finding out about the acute illnesses related to vaping more than a decade after the devices have been out on the market.
There have always been certainly concerns. I think one really looks at the a very seminal report, which was came out in 2018. The National Academy of Sciences and Medicine issued really what, you know, now is well over a year and a half old and needs to be completely updated. But they looked at what do we know about e-cigarettes that's conclusive? What do we know about them in terms of health consequences that's, you know, certainly substantial? And then what do we know about them that certainly is worrisome? And in each areas they gave levels of evidence. So for instance, they said that they contain and emit many potentially toxic substances. That was conclusive in 2018. Said they can explode and cause burns and projectile injuries. Again, another conclusive. And then finally, that they can cause seizures and acidosis and other kind of central nervous system effects. Again, a conclusive. We knew with our kids that if they drank them or otherwise exposed, it could be fatal with young kids. And so these were things that were known. And then there was a lot of things that were worried about, you know, that they certainly, it appeared that they were addictive. Certainly that there could, at a cellular level, cause some cell dysfunction. They could cause damage to DNA, and that their use among youth could be associated with combustible cigarettes, and that it increased the risk, at least, of youth using those. So these are the things I think we kind of knew if you were working in my field, which is you look at the research and you're doing the research. What I think has evolved in the last months and weeks and days is this epidemic of this toxic lung injuries that have occurred among people using vaping devices. What we don't know, though, with any degree of certainty is what is the role of the electronic nicotine delivery system or the e-cigarette as it relates to that versus other exposures, because many, if not most of those people have also been using cannabis of some form and using the vaping product to deliver more than one product. And so I think there's a lot of concern that the bootleg cannabis that maybe has some vitamin E oil or other things that could really explain the most recent explosion of injuries.
That was Dr. Adam Goldstein, professor and the director of the tobacco intervention programs at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Now, last Wednesday, India banned the sale of electronic cigarettes and warned of an epidemic among young people. It's the latest and potentially biggest move globally against vaping over growing health concerns. The ban cuts off a huge future market from e-cigarette makers at a time when the number of people smoking worldwide is declining. It could dash the expansion plans of companies such as Juul Labs and Philip Morris International in the country. The ban also covers the production, import, and advertising of e-cigarettes, but not the use of them. Patrick Reynolds is the CEO and the founder of the Foundation for a Tobacco-Free World. He's also a grandson of cigarette company founder R.J. Reynolds. I asked him, from a policy standpoint, what should be done.
When the first boats started coming over with e-cigarette products, my first instinct was send them back. There's not a lot of control, especially among the smaller e-cigarette manufacturers. The rate of e-cigarette use was 1.5% among high school kids. And today, it has soared in the last 10 years over to 20%.
What do you think is the best policy aspect in protecting people from, you know, this device?
When it comes to policy, we know the policies that are going to work. You know, we have plenty of scientific-based evidence-based studies showing that the policies are that have reduced tobacco use would work on e-cigarettes as well, and certainly taxing them at a high rate, similar to tobacco, or even higher. Secondly, a ban its use in public, in restaurants and bars and so on, so that the smoking bans were the second factor in reducing smoking in our country. And the third factor is education campaigns in the media. There is a new movement to a fourth policy that can be implemented by government is to raise the purchase age to 21. So you can't buy them unless you're 21 or over. And you have to appear to be 26 or the merchant has to card you.
Patrick Reynolds is the CEO of the Foundation for a Tobacco-Free World and also a grandson of R.J. Reynolds, who was the founder of one of the most popular cigarette companies in the world. After a three-year closure, the Washington Monument has reopened to the public. The 170-meter stone obelisk was closed in September 2016 in order to replace the aging elevator and upgrade security systems. Mike Litteris, spokesman for the National Park Service, has these details.
Washington Monument is really one of America's first major public-private construction partnerships. The Washington National Monument Society began construction in 1848. They got to about 150 feet before they ran out of money. The Civil War came along shortly after that, and the monument sat incomplete for about 22 years. Congress finally stepped in 1876, took over the project, gave it to the Army Corps of Engineers to finish. It was declared completed in 1884 and opened to the public in 1888. Just like its construction, the recent work we did was also public-private partnership. Businessman and philanthropist David Rubenstein made a very generous donation of $3 million to allow us to modernize the elevator. The National Park Service appropriated budget funded the construction of the security screening facility. What's new at the monument, we think of most importance, is the fact that the elevator is now far more reliable than it was when it forced our closure in 2016. The other main thing people are going to notice is as they get on the elevator, for the first time in the Washington Monument's history, there will not be a ranger or an attendant riding with you. It's fully automated now. The video monitors on the walls provide the interpretation and the information from the ranger. When the monument was completed in 1884, it was the world's tallest building, bar none. Was eclipsed shortly thereafter with the completion of the Eiffel Tower. But today, the Washington Monument is still the world's tallest freestanding masonry structure. There is no steel, there is no iron that holds it up. It's just the weight of the stones and gravity that holds it in place.
That was Mike Litteris, spokesman for the National Park Service. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Tracy Carter, engineer Greg Burns, and managing editor Kate Pound Dawson, thank you so much for listening. You'll be able to find in-depth coverage of world events and news at the VOA News website. And don't forget, with our mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.
This is VOA News. I'm Tom.